You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Ukraine's massive drone attack on Russia has stunned the world.
It is truly extraordinary. It appears that Ukraine has been planning this for over a year and a half.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the upshot of that attack, and Poland's new president says people voted for a normal Poland.
Cały obóz ludzi, którzy chcą Polski normalnej.
A Poland without immigrants. In Gaza, more deadly chaos at an aid distribution site overwhelmed by hungry people.
Of course they're going to rush to these locations. Of course they're going to stampede. Of course they're just going to grab whatever it is that they can.
And concerns for the well-being of Tibetan students in Chinese residential schools.
Very young children, there's just never a good reason to take them away from their families.
Plus, rescued moths, all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Marco Werman is out this week. Delegations from Russia and Ukraine met face-to-face in Istanbul today for just the second time since Russia launched its full-scale invasion in 2022. This comes at a moment of utter surprise for watchers of this conflict, as Ukraine just carried out a drone attack of epic proportions inside Russia. We will have more on that in a moment. First, we begin today's show with those diplomatic efforts in Turkey. The World's Duri Buscarin has our report from Istanbul.
I'm here standing on what is usually the helipad of a five-star hotel on the shores of the Bosphorus Strait. Today, the garden has been entirely converted into kind of a press center for delegations from all over the world. We're here waiting on the results of a second round of peace negotiations between Ukraine and Russia. And it comes off the heels of one of the most destructive weekends in the course of the war. Over the weekend, before it was clear that Ukraine would join the peace talks, Russia launched hundreds of drones and several missiles towards Sumy, Kharkiv, and Dnipro, hitting a training base and killing at least 12 soldiers. A few hours later, Ukraine launched 117 drone strikes against Russian air bases in five regions across the country, destroying at least 40 aircraft, according to Ukrainian officials. Russian military bloggers called it a black day for the country's air defenses. So this was the background as delegations met in Istanbul today. As you might expect, expectations were low. Negotiating teams met for an hour and 15 minutes in what had been a 19th century Ottoman palace, the Chiran Saraya. Afterwards, chaos, as a scrum of reporters surrounded lead Russian negotiator Vladimir Medinsky as he walked outside to make brief comments to the press.
We agreed on the exchanges.
It's hard to hear him, but Medinsky confirmed that Russia and Ukraine had agreed to a prisoner exchange of up to 1,000 service members. During a press conference held by the Ukrainian delegation, Defense Minister Rustem Umerov said the prisoner exchange would focus on two categories of soldiers.
We agreed to exchange all for all, seriously wounded and seriously sick prisoners of war. Second category is young soldiers who are from 18 to 25 years old, all for all.
The two sides also agreed to return 6,000 bodies of fallen soldiers on each side. This would likely mean a 2 to 3 day ceasefire, the Russian delegation said. According to Umerov, the Ukrainian delegation gave Russia a list of names of Ukrainian children allegedly abducted and held in Russian territory. Russia denies this claim, but Umerov said that the return of even half of these children would help the negotiations move along. Umerov also urged Russian President Vladimir Putin to show up to negotiate in person next time.
We firmly believe that all key issues can only be solved at the level of leaders.
The Ukrainian delegation declined to comment on Russia's demands, which were not shared with the press, saying they would take a week to review the documents before deciding on further steps. The Ukrainian delegation said they hope to have another round of peace talks before the end of June. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin. Istanbul.
As we just heard, Ukraine attacked Russia over the weekend in what analysts are calling a strategic and symbolic blow to the Kremlin. More than 100 Ukrainian drones smuggled into Russia hit targets throughout the country, even places as remote as Siberia. I spoke today with Samuel Bendett, an advisor at the Center for Naval Analyses. He specializes in Russian military capabilities and autonomous military systems. He called Ukraine's attack truly extraordinary.
It appears that Ukraine has been planning this for over a year and a half, and they probably meticulously monitored military airports, military bases, and they essentially rented what appears to be a warehouse in one of Russia's cities, where they carefully smuggled short-range FPV-type quadcopters. And then they've refitted regular shipping containers, which are used in Russia all over by the millions. They've refitted those containers to house those drones and to launch those drones automatically.
Wow. How seriously does this attack hamper Russia's ability to strike Ukraine?
Well, that's a question that I think everybody's trying to figure out right now. First of all, obviously, it's the number of aircraft that was destroyed that is in question. Ukrainian officials are saying that up to 40 Russian bombers were damaged or destroyed. Russians are saying that a lot fewer were destroyed. Open source intelligence points to a number somewhere in between. And so the question is whether or not the remaining strategic aircraft are enough to launch missiles against Ukraine. And it is likely that's the case. It is likely that whatever remains in Russian service is still enough to pose a significant danger to Ukraine. What is, however, significant here is that a lot of the aircraft that were damaged are rather irreplaceable. They were made during the Cold War. They're many decades old. They were modernized by the Russian military. But the bottom line is this particular action, on top of all the other drone attacks that Ukraine has conducted against the Russian territory, Russian industry, Russian military targets. This is unlikely to alter Russia's military course in Ukraine, at least for now.
How important is this in terms of symbolism and being a kind of psychological victory for Ukraine? I mean, is this likely to help bolster support from allies who like to see a win, for lack of a better word?
It is a very significant psychological blow to Russia's sense of invulnerability. Over the weekend and going into this week, there was and will be a lot of commentary from a lot of Russian military commentators and bloggers who were saying that they warned the Russian military that such an attack can actually take place. And the military has ignored warnings to protect the aircraft, either in hangars or in some kind of physical structures. And so those bombers were basically open air targets for such an attack. This is a wake-up call, quite possibly, for other militaries around the world that have bases where their expensive long-range aircraft are also stationed in the open airfield. If Ukrainians can pull this off, others can pull this off as well. Other commentators noted that this particular container launch technology is not new, that it's been around for about a decade or so, and that Ukrainians basically had the audacity and the desire to pull this off. But again, others can try to do the same as well. This technology is not necessarily proprietary. The software on which this was based is open source, and others can attempt to repeat this as well.
And the drones that they used, you mentioned they are quadcopters. Those are these small drones that we see flying around just for fun here in the U.S., right?
Well, they're related to that. Those specific quadcopters were 15-inch FPV drones, first-person view drones that were probably custom-built for this particular operation. But the parts and components and the basic engineering for those FPVs is something that is around world over, including here in the United States. This is a very embarrassing attack. It's an embarrassing loss. It is a very expensive loss. But again, it's the one that probably doesn't alter Russia's military course in Ukraine at the moment, considering that so much warfare in Ukraine is taking place on the ground, and Russia is willing to waste thousands of soldiers a week just to gain a few meters of territory on a daily basis.
Samuel Bendett spoke to us from the Center for Naval Analyses. In the Tibetan region of China, children are experiencing physical abuse and neglect in government-run boarding schools. That's according to a new report by the Tibet Action Institute. The group says the schools are designed to separate Tibetan children from their parents and from their culture. Lawdon Titong is the director of the Tibet Action Institute based in Boston. She explains how the Chinese government organizes the schools.
They've closed and consolidated schools across Tibet. So they've just funneled nearly all of the kids. By our numbers, at least 78% of all school-aged children between the ages of 6 and 18 into these massive system of state-run boarding schools.
You found evidence of physical abuse and neglect in these schools. How widespread does that seem to be?
Yeah, I think the biggest finding for us and the most devastating one of this report is that children are vulnerable to abuse and neglect, often serious abuse, widely across the boarding school system. Some of these schools have thousands of kids, and we're talking about elementary age kids living with only so many people to watch over them. And it's bullying, many, many reports of teachers hitting students. And we have cases, unfortunately, we've documented ones that have leaked onto social media despite the information blackout on Tibet. And that we document in the report of very young children being quite brutally beaten up by, in one case, the principal of the school, who we have video evidence of, who was also the local party secretary, just openly beating up this young boy, 9 or 10 years old, on the school grounds in front of teachers, in front of students. But we have many more reports from Tibetan parents, students, former students, who say that that is widespread in terms of the life of these Tibetan kids in the schools.
This report states that the Chinese government has expanded their efforts to limit children's access to their language and culture. How are they doing that?
It's not just that Tibetans will only get one Tibetan language class, the students in these schools, and everything else is Mandarin medium instruction. So you have Tibetan essentially being taught as a second language or a foreign language style in the schools. And then what parents would do to remedy that is on holidays or vacations, there would be vacation classes in the village or at the local monastery. And now Chinese authorities have forbidden those. And in fact, recently in the winter break, there were reports of house-to-house searches. We've seen memos that have gone home, notices to parents saying not just no Tibetan language classes, no outside classes that aren't sanctioned by the government, but also you can't take them to monasteries. They don't want Tibetan influence and identity in these children's lives in a meaningful way, because the goal of the system is to turn them into loyal Chinese Communist Party followers who are not going to challenge in any way China's rule in Tibet.
I would imagine that is not exactly how China, the government, talks about the goal of these schools. What does it say their purpose or need is?
Yeah, the Chinese government says that this is essentially the way to offer a modern education and top quality facilities to Tibetan kids in a landscape that's sparsely populated and can be treacherous for kids to get to school. Ultimately, the Tibetans could get to school locally. We do have many examples now. We know of kids being forced to board even when they're just half an hour from school. At the same time, the Chinese government is essentially trying to convince the world that, in this case, 1 million of one group's children, so 1 million kids, must live in boarding school because there's no other way to educate them. But we can see at the same time, they've built incredible infrastructure in Tibet. They have built a network of roads in rural areas that they regularly, what we document in the report, that they explain how easily people can get from one place to another now. And so they ultimately, that argument doesn't hold up, that this is the only way to educate kids when one really looks at it. And I think fundamentally, just everybody who looks at this can see that very young children, there's just never a good reason to take them away from their families. This is the standard recognized in international sort of education, that kids, their psychological foundation, their social, emotional learning and growth and health, that all starts with the family and, in fact, with mother tongue-based education. And that's what Tibetans are being denied.
Lawdon Titong is director of Tibet Action Institute in Boston. You're listening to The World.
Hey there, it's Marco Werman along with Carolyn Beeler, your hosts.
We hope you think that the journalism we do adds something to your life. Maybe it helps you understand the world around you a little bit better or sparks your curiosity about a place you've never been before.
We're able to bring you critical reporting about news and current affairs around the globe because listeners like you support the work of our newsroom. From now until June 30th, we have a goal of raising $25,000, and we're hoping you can help us reach it.
Thanks to a generous donor who has already stepped up to give, your donations will be matched 2-to-1. That means if you give $25, we get $75. A $100 donation means we'll have $300 in the bank to fund our journalism. Whatever amount you can give helps us bring you news from around the globe 5 days a week.
We hope you will seriously consider supporting our work. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to donate.
Thank you so much from everyone here at The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. South Korea is gearing up for an election tomorrow, and the country should see a new president sworn into office right after that on Wednesday. Typically, the transition takes 2 months, but these are unusual times for South Korea. The World's Matthew Bell has that story for us.
South Korea has been through a lot in the last 6 months. It started with a shocking declaration of martial law by President Yoon Suk-yeol. What followed was Yoon's impeachment, a trial at the Constitutional Court, and his removal from office. There have been huge demonstrations every week for and against impeachment, and the country has become deeply divided politically. On the street in South Korea's capital, Kim Min-soo told the BBC that he's burned out. He used to watch all the political news shows and debates on TV, but said he's completely lost interest. This moment feels desperate, Kim So-young said. But maybe if we elect a better president, this chaotic situation will improve. Celeste Arrington is the director of the Institute for Korean Studies at George Washington University. At this point, she tells me, a lot of South Koreans describe what they're dealing with as impeachment insomnia. They've had 3 different acting presidents, months of uncertainty about who's really in charge, and real setbacks for South Korea's economy, created in part by the tariffs imposed by President Donald Trump.
It seems like, at least from the reporting in the Korean media, that Washington is not really taking Seoul seriously.
Whoever wins Tuesday's presidential election will need to play catch-up with the new U.S. administration and face some major challenges at home, starting with the political divide between liberals and conservatives. Arrington says the polarization is undermining South Korea's democratic system.
In particular, the willingness of both sides to step beyond the bounds of normal democratic institutions, sort of vindictive politics, and an unwillingness to tolerate the other side.
The polls suggest there are really 2 frontrunners, Yi Jae-myung, the leader of the Liberal Democratic Party, and the top conservative candidate, Kim Eun-soo. He's with the People Power Party. Kim is promising to strengthen the relationship with the U.S., build up South Korea's military, and take a hard line with North Korea. But he's refused to criticize President Yoon's decision to declare martial law, which was deeply unpopular. And the conservative vote is likely to be split anyway between Kim and another right-wing candidate with about 10% support in the polls. That makes Yi Jae-myung the man to beat. He narrowly lost the last presidential race by less than 1%. And he's been presenting himself to voters as the only candidate who can overcome the country's political divisions. Celeste Arrington says Yi has promised not to pursue vindictive politics if he's elected.
To what extent that's campaign rhetoric versus reality, I think, remains to be seen.
If Yi becomes president and his Democratic Party keeps its majority in the legislature, that may help tone down the political atmosphere. But even so, President Yi would still face pressure from his political left. Hwang Jong-yun is with the Progressive Democratic Labor Party. She says Yi has a history of paying lip service to liberal causes and then not following through.
Democratic Party have shown their policy is getting closer to the Conservative Party, which means a pro-capitalist, pro-corporate, pro-the-rich.
In the past, progressive politicians in South Korea have expressed skepticism about the country's alliance with the U.S. Not Yi Jae-myung, though. He recently described the relationship with the United States as the backbone of South Korea's national security. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Poland's election over the weekend was won by the conservative nationalist candidate. It was a razor-thin victory, but a stinging defeat for Prime Minister Donald Tusk. The election of Karol Nawrocki could derail Tusk's promise to ease up Poland's most conservative policies. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has been tracking the reaction. Orla, the next president of Poland, Karol Nawrocki, tell us about him.
Well, he's a prominent conservative historian, but he's had very little to no political experience. He's a former amateur boxer. In the lead up to the election, there were all sorts of stories about him taking part in fights involving football hooligans and plenty of other scandals, all of which he managed to brush off. He's a supporter of President Trump's. He went to Washington during the last few weeks of the election campaign, had a very brief meeting, we understand, and more importantly, a photo op with Trump. He ran a strong campaign, very clear messaging, centred on maintaining traditional Catholic values and strongly opposing immigration. And even on the stage last night, after the election win, he shared some more of that rhetoric.
Udało nam się zjednoczyć cały obóz patriotyczny.
So he said, we managed to unite the entire patriotic camp in Poland, people who want a normal Poland, who want a Poland without illegal immigrants, a safe Poland.
I understand, though, Orla, that the role of president in Poland is pretty much ceremonial. So how actually important is this, and how much of a setback is it to Prime Minister Donald Tusk, who is one of the people spearheading this hoped-for move away from conservative policies in Poland?
It's true. I mean, the role of the president, it isn't like in the U.S. It's much more of a position where he can assist or resist the government. But one of his key powers is that he can veto legislation. So what has happened up to now is that the current president, Andrzej Duda, who's also from the conservative right, this Law and Justice Party that supported Karol Nawrocki as well, he has been able to veto or threaten to veto any of the reforms that Donald Tusk has been wanting to introduce. And analysts in Poland that I talked to today said they expect Nawrocki to be much more aggressive in the way he responds to Tusk's suggested reforms than Duda did.
Tusk came into power specifically with a promise to ease Poland's strict abortion laws. That has not happened so far. Given the news here, how likely is it that it will happen now?
Honestly, very unlikely. Karol Nawrocki is strongly pro-life. I was talking to Jakub Jarosiewski earlier today. He's with the NGO Democracy Reporting International in Poland. And he was pointing out that it's not only abortion that's likely to be affected now.
By the way, same goes for LGBT rights. I think that the bill on civil partnerships, same-sex civil partnerships that are being worked on by the government right now in Poland, is dead and won't happen for a long time.
What about Poland's standing in Europe and its support for Ukraine? It has historically been a big supporter. Could that be affected?
Yeah, and in terms of Europe, it was interesting to see who was most vocal in their support of Nawrocki today. You had Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, calling it a fantastic victory. Marine Le Pen, the far-right leader of the National Rally Party in France, she called it good news. In terms of Ukraine, on the campaign trail, he did agree that Poland should continue providing weapons to Ukraine, but he has also been vocal that he would block Ukraine's bid to join NATO. There were times on the trail where he sounded a little like President Trump. He accused Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky of showing insufficient gratitude towards Poland for its assistance. So I guess for Ukraine and the EU today, it's certainly not a result that they'll be happy about, at least privately.
The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carolyn.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Buehler. The humanitarian situation in Gaza continues to deteriorate, and this weekend's shooting in Rafah near a distribution site for aid is adding to the suffering and chaos. According to the International Committee of the Red Cross, more than 20 people were killed after gunfire broke out. That's on top of more than 100 people wounded. Local health officials say Israeli soldiers fired on civilians, but the Israel Defense Forces blames Hamas militants for the violence. Arwa Damon is with the International Network for Aid, Relief and Assistance, which she founded, and she joined us from Istanbul. Arwa, what are you hearing from people on the ground about Sunday's shooting and how it happened?
Well, to first of all set the scene, it was very close to dawn in the middle of the night when this took place. And the reason why there were such large crowds is because they were all walking towards this hub that was set up by the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that is backed by the U.S. and Israel and meant to provide an alternate formula for aid distribution. But people have to walk for hours to get to the hub. And so they start walking in the middle of the night. And it was roughly, according to a couple of the eyewitnesses, when they were about a kilometer, so just under a mile away from, you know, where they should be receiving their food parcels, that they say that is when the gunfire started. And people talk about seeing a quadcopter that is used by Israel firing at them. One eyewitness very specifically describes a soldier on top of a crane shooting into the crowd. And it's hardly the first time that we have these sort of conflicting narratives between what Israel says, which is basically to blame everything on Hamas, and what we hear from people on the ground. But the crux of this really is that this is such an illustration of exactly why it is that this aid distribution mechanism quite simply does not work.
Right. This is not the first deadly shooting that has taken place around these facilities in the, what, week that they have been open?
Yes, exactly. But the thing is when it comes to humanitarian distribution, first of all, this is not how you crowd control, obviously. And secondly, this is exactly why you don't just set up four hubs to try to distribute food to starving people. Even in the best of times, crowd control is very difficult. Add to that the sheer level of desperation that we have in Gaza. Parents are watching their children in agony starving for food. Of course they're going to rush to these locations. Of course they're going to stampede. Of course they're just going to grab whatever it is that they can. This is exactly why the United Nations has 400 distribution hubs all over Gaza, plus everything else that other organizations have established for distribution. Or you also have organizations like mine, INARA for short, that delivers straight to the communities and the shelters that we work with. Humanitarian organizations know how to distribute humanitarian assistance.
Are you convinced that anyone, though, has a detailed, accurate picture of what is happening? Every side in this conflict is capable of manipulating the narrative.
Sure, of course. That's what happens in conflict. But when you have numerous eyewitnesses and when you have videos who emerge that show people coming under fire, one also needs to ask why it is that we find it so difficult to believe what Palestinians are telling us and why we find it so easy to believe what Israel is telling us. And I think the answer to that question goes to the core of how it is that, you know, we, global leaders, the international community, have allowed what is happening in Gaza to get this far.
How could this be done right now to get this aid that's so desperately needed to people in Gaza?
Open the border, let the tens of thousands of trucks in, and let humanitarian organizations on the ground do their job. This whole alternative aid distribution mechanism, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, this is all based on this false narrative that Hamas controls the aid. Hamas does not control the aid. And even if we were to try to sort of penetrate the logic behind it and say, okay, well, Israel has accused the UN of being anti-Semitic, et cetera, et cetera. So it's accusing the UN of collaborating with Hamas. The World Central Kitchen is not accused of anything. And yet they too are not being permitted to bring their trucks in. They have the capacity to feed hundreds of thousands of people every single day. And even if we were to take this false narrative to be true, even if we were to work with the assumption of Hamas is stealing all the aid, and that's why we need these hubs to be set up, it still doesn't make sense, because who is protecting the aid once this person has picked up their box and is walking back to their tent? And it also doesn't make sense, because if Israel wants to accuse Hamas of financially benefiting from aid, the best way to combat that is to ensure that aid no longer has a monetary value. The only reason why aid has a monetary value, why a sack of flour can cost anywhere from $400 to $600, why an onion costs $10, is because of scarcity.
Who or what has the leverage to change this situation right now? You've outlined what changes would need to happen to get aid in. Where are you looking for that to come from?
If we were talking about what specifically what is preventing aid from getting into Gaza, that is Israel. And if we're talking specifically about who has any sort of power or sway or ability to convince Israel to do otherwise, that is the United States.
Arwa Damon is the founder of the International Network for Aid, Relief, and Assistance. She joined us from Istanbul. The Fulbright program has been a prestigious tool for American diplomacy since the end of World War II. It sent U.S. scholars abroad and welcomed international researchers in, building soft power. The program is currently under existential threat from the State Department, which runs it. As the world's Joshua Koh learned, it could take decades to fully understand the repercussions.
In 1946, a senator from Arkansas, James William Fulbright, had a novel idea for the U.S. government, an American educational exchange program to rival the prestigious Rhodes Scholarship in the United Kingdom.
According to his biographers, he found his experience as a Rhodes Scholar so transforming and so significant for him.
Gerardo Blanco is director for the Center of International Higher Education at Boston College. Blanco says that Fulbright was a complicated man. He advocated for segregation in the U.S.
At the same time, in the global sphere, he was an advocate of mutual understanding, of saying we don't necessarily have to like each other, but we should be able to be in dialogue with each other. And I think that is very powerful within the Fulbright program.
Since it started, the program has awarded over 400,000 scholarships to U.S. and foreign citizens. About half of the 8,000 or so Fulbright scholars are Americans heading overseas. The other half are coming to the U.S. from more than 100 countries. The program is run by the U.S. State Department, which handles American diplomacy. William Taylor is a former ambassador to Ukraine and has served as a diplomat under the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations.
The most effective programs that I have seen in terms of value to the United States and value to the recipient countries are exchange programs. Fulbright, of course, is one of the premier.
The former ambassador says that programs like Fulbright are a crucial yet quiet element of U.S. foreign policy strategy known as soft power. The concept that America can influence the rest of the world on the merit of its values, culture, and democratic principles. He says that during their time in the U.S., Fulbright scholars get to see what the country is really like.
That connection affects them. And when they come to a decision, as they become a member of parliament or as they become a person in business, as they are making decisions, that understanding of the United States and of our culture, of our people and individuals has an effect which is in our interest.
44 heads of government across the globe have been Fulbright scholars. And at the cost of about $300 million per year, the program has consistently found bipartisan support on Capitol Hill.
It seems like every time that you're in a foreign country and you're visiting with the cabinet members, you know, half of them are Fulbright scholars, and they're very, very proud of it.
That's Senator John Bozeman, a Republican from Fulbright's home state of Arkansas. At a committee meeting this month, Bozeman urged Secretary of State Marco Rubio not only to preserve the Fulbright program, but to strengthen it.
The opportunity for the leadership of these other countries across the ranks to have them such that they're very, very familiar with the United States in that way, I think is really invaluable.
Well, and I think that's most certainly going to be a part of our process. As you know,
the State Department's proposed budget for 2026 would cut spending on exchange programs by 93%. But the squeeze on Fulbright has already been felt by scholars. In February, the Department of State froze grant funding to current Fulbright scholars. That left international scholars stranded in the U.S., and Americans like Dr. Nicole E. Williams stuck without money overseas.
One of my colleagues said, hey, I didn't get my second set of funding. Do you know anything about it? And none of us knew anything about it. And then finally we got heard something from the news that the funding had been cut.
Williams is a gynecologist from Chicago who was conducting research at a university in Uganda. As a Fulbright scholar, her research was supposed to help make pregnancy and childbirth safer for mothers in the area. And as she told WBEZ, it wasn't just her grant money that disappeared. America's soft power footprint was also leaving Uganda.
You can't go anywhere without seeing a USAID sign here in Uganda and many of the places where I've been. Now it's all gone. The reason that we are loved so much is because we do this kind of work.
Despite already being approved by the Fulbright program and after a year-long application process, Sarah Lokola, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Helsinki in Finland, was notified earlier this month that her Fulbright was canceled.
I received this one sentence through Fulbright Finland that it's not compliant with executive orders and can no longer be considered for the grant.
No further explanation was given, but Lokola believes the project was declined because it conflicts with a Trump administration order to terminate diversity, equity, and inclusion offices, positions, and programs in the federal government. Lokola's Fulbright project was supposed to examine how teachers in the U.S. handle racism in the classroom. The State Department did not respond to my request for comment on its policy changes. But the former ambassador, William Taylor, warns that damage done now to the program could affect U.S. foreign policy down the line.
That will have a direct effect on our relations over time. It'll be a cost that we won't see immediately. It's hard to measure the effect of any individual exchange program. These are valuable over time.
One measure of U.S. foreign policy success that won't exist without exchange programs is counting heads of state who came to the U.S. as Fulbright scholars, who got a firsthand look at the American way of life. Baseball, democracy, Dunkin' Donuts and all. For The World, I'm Joshua Koh.
Biologists at Mexico City's Natural History Museum have been taking care of rescued moths, specifically the Oryseba silk moth. It's also known as the Four Mirrors moth because of the translucent triangles on their wings, and the butterfly of obsidian knives in the language of the Aztecs. Very cool name. The palm-sized moths are native to South and Central America, but their numbers have been decreasing in Mexico City due to urbanization. The Natural History Museum there rescued 2,600 cocoons from an empty lot and brought them back to a butterfly sanctuary. Biologist Maria Eugenia Diaz Batres has been taking care of them since December. She says she thought the rehabilitation would take a long time. But I welcomed them with great pleasure, she adds. She cleaned the cocoons and hugged them from clothing lines all over, including in her office. And now they are emerging from their cocoons. The wait, presumably, was worth it. The year Massachusetts approved a law allowing undocumented immigrants to drive legally, the number of new driver's licenses issued in the state doubled. That was 2023. Immigrants in Massachusetts are still pursuing licenses in high numbers, despite widespread fear of handing over data during a national crackdown on immigration. Chris Burrell at GBH in Boston reports.
Electric clippers are buzzing at this barbershop outside Boston, where an undocumented immigrant works full-time. He says, speaking through a Portuguese interpreter, his 12-hour workdays have left him no time to go through the process of getting a driver's license. But he wants one, and soon.
I've never had an accident in Brazil or here. I have a record of good driving. I just ask God that nothing happens from now until I get my license.
He requested anonymity for fear for his safety, but he says he is eager to join the estimated tens of thousands of other immigrants who have taken advantage of the Work and Family Mobility Act, a law allowing adults to obtain licenses regardless of their immigration status. Jennifer Klein supports immigrants at the state's public defender's office. She says many see the licenses as a basic line of defense for undocumented immigrants to stay out of trouble under the new Trump administration.
You roll through a stop sign, you get pulled over. That would just be a fine. That's not going to trigger any sort of immigration enforcement. But you get pulled over and you don't have a license, all of a sudden you've committed a criminal offense.
Monica Adwani owns an insurance company in Framingham called Breezy Seguros, whose clients are primarily Latino. She says the fear of sharing data with the state could dampen the drive for licenses.
There is a big desire from the community to obtain the driver's license, but there is a lot of hesitation right now and a lot of fear.
It's impossible to determine how many of these new licenses belong to undocumented immigrants, because that information is not in the records. But a spokesperson for Attorney General Andrea Campbell says her office will fight any attempts by immigration authorities to access the data. Gladys Vega, who directs the Chelsea nonprofit La Collaborativa, says local immigrants are counting on that promise.
That's what we have told our community, and from the get-go, that was going to be protected by the state government, and that data should never be released.
Vega says the surge of driver's licenses issued since 2023 shows a strong desire among immigrants to be lawful and to push back against negative stereotypes. But under Trump, she says, the enforcement is targeting everyone.
Right now, there's no due process. You're detaining people with residency. You're detaining people with work authorization, people on their way to work.
Advocates and even local police praise the impacts of the law here in Massachusetts. It has generated millions of dollars of revenue. It's led to a decline in unlicensed driving, meaning there are more drivers who are trained and tested in rules of the road. Ruben Casada is the police chief in Swampscott, a seaside town about an hour north of Boston. He helps lead a national law enforcement task force on immigration. He says the law is helping build trust with immigrants, not fear, and that makes everybody safer.
It shows Massachusetts as being a leader in creating pathways for undocumented individuals to live their daily lives, driving the kids to school, driving to work, going to the grocery store, attending church on Sundays.
That policy achievement here and in 18 other states with similar laws is being tested now, like never before. For The World, I'm Chris Burrell in Boston.
You're listening to The World. Russia has been on a church-building binge. The Russian Orthodox Church, in particular, has been making up for lost time after the secular Soviet era. Over the past 15 years, thousands of new churches have gone up across the country, including hundreds in Moscow alone. But some of the projects have faced opposition, either of the NIMBY sort or from people who are leery of closer ties between church and state. Levi Bridges explains.
There's a huge park in Moscow lined with maple trees and shrubs called Afghan Square. It's named in honor of Soviet veterans who served in Afghanistan. For years, Muscovites have been protesting against a city plan to build a church here. And they were successful, too, until bulldozers showed up last fall. One woman films as another single-handedly tries to stop them from breaking ground. There are churches everywhere. We don't need another one, the retired local resident says. Locals managed to stop the construction, but the effort is getting exhausting, they say. I WhatsApped with a woman who lives near Afghan Square. She didn't want to give her name because people who oppose the church have received threats. She says, our opposition isn't anti-religious. We just want a park to go walk the dog. Not long ago, some Russians were practically begging for churches. The Soviet Union tried to create an atheist state. Many places of worship were still closed to religious services when the USSR collapsed in 1991.
There was a period when there were not enough churches.
Maxim Trudolubov is an editor with the Kennan Institute. He took drawing classes back in the early 90s, held in this beautiful 16th century church in Moscow that was turned into university space.
It was completely empty inside, white walls, no murals, nothing survived.
Back then, Trudolubov and other Russians were joining the Orthodox Church. He and some other students successfully petitioned to kick the university out and turn this historic building back into a church. Suddenly, they had their own congregation.
We were a bunch of kids, and there was not even an adult in the room.
The Russian Orthodox Church eventually gained control of many of these buildings. Sergei Chapnin formerly worked with the church and is now with Fordham University. He argues the Orthodox Church consolidated its power and influence in post-Soviet Russia by pursuing an ideological alliance with the political elite.
Church officials were doing their best to convince the state that the Orthodox tradition should be the basis of the new Russian society. And they succeeded, especially after Putin became president.
He argues the church and state collaborated to reconstruct the more conservative Orthodox version of Russia that existed a century ago, a new empire based on traditional values in opposition to the more liberal West. And this project requires building places of worship in old Soviet neighborhoods that didn't have them.
It makes our capital beautiful and religious, as it always used to be before our revolution.
Vakhtang Kipchidze is the vice spokesman for the church. He says families with small children need to be able to get to church on foot. Most Russians aren't opposed to building churches, Kipchidze says. And those that are usually have anti-religious views or have been manipulated by opposition politicians like Russia's Communist Party.
If there is a real danger to reasonable and legal interests of local people, of course, their concerns will be taken into consideration by our church in a very favorable way.
In the past decade, hundreds of new churches have been built everywhere, from St. Petersburg to Siberia. But research shows only a small percentage of Russians go to church regularly. Nikolai Mitrohin is a fellow at Bremen University, focusing on Russia's Orthodox Church.
Now, usually, churches is not full. The number of the believers in Russia not growing up.
The church believes that trend can be reversed and continues to build. On YouTube, a video shows workers chainsawing trees in a park to make way for a church as supporters sing. A Russian journalist interviewed a supporter of church construction who says for him, orthodoxy is part of being Russian. To ensure the survival of the Russian people, we need faith and churches, he says. But in 2019, thousands protested against a proposed church in Yekaterinburg, one of Russia's largest cities. The project was ultimately canceled after more than half of locals surveyed said they didn't want the church. Alyona Smishlaeva participated in these protests. She says since Russia invaded Ukraine, protest movements have been stifled. Lots of activists, myself included, left Russia, she says. And who can think about a construction project when kids are dying in Ukraine? Back in Moscow's Afghan Square, footage on Russian state TV shows soldiers from the Ukraine war gathering to pray and honor their fallen comrades. Officials now want the proposed church to become a memorial honoring Russian veterans. The woman I talked to who opposes the church says the rebranding complicated their efforts. Now, if you're against the church, then you're against veterans and the government, she says. That's a problem because it's illegal in Russia to oppose the war. Recently, bulldozers returned to Afghan Square and workers put up a fence. This time, nobody stopped them. This spring, one Muscovite poked their cell phone through the fence in the park and films workers laying the church's foundation. A worker inside throws a rock at them. This year, plans are in the works to build more than a dozen new churches in Moscow alone. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges, Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and subscribe to The World wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss a show. I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Helen and Russell Pine, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.